On Thursday, July 23rd in 1846, Henry David Thoreau was walking into town from Walden Pond to pick up some shoes that he'd had repaired. Along the way, he ran into the local tax collector, Sam Staples, who was actually looking for him. You see, Staples was hoping to resign soon from his position as tax collector, and before he did, he wanted to settle his outstanding accounts. Thoreau hadn't paid taxes in over 4 years. He was doing that as a protest against the Mexican-American War. We think of it just as the Mexican-American War, but it was a war he condemned as a violent and imperialist expansion of slavery. Now, Sam Staples and Henry David Thoreau were old friends. They'd actually grown up together in Concord, Massachusetts. I did my field ed assignment in Lincoln, Massachusetts, which is right next door to Concord. And if you've ever been there, Concord is still a small town. Over the years, Staples had gently reminded his friend that he needed to pay his taxes. He once even offered to pay Thoreau's taxes for him, but Thoreau wouldn't let him. So after 4 years, Sam Staples had had enough. And that day, well, also he was getting ready to retire. And that day when Thoreau once again refused to pay his tax, Staples took his friend by the arm and put him in the Concord jail and told him he'd stay there until he paid his taxes. So here's that, where Thoreau got Thoreau in jail. Now word spread quickly through Concord of Thoreau's imprisonment, and in the middle of the night, someone, we don't know who, although it's reputed to be his aunt, came to the jailhouse and, much to Thoreau's chagrin, paid his debt. And the next morning, Staples released him. Thoreau picked up his mended shoes and headed back to Walden Pond. Not exactly a dramatic, principled story of martyrdom. Thoreau himself would recount the story in a self-deprecating way, saying, "This is the whole history of my prisons." Yet somehow, this humble story would inspire leaders and revolutions. Looking out his prison window that night, Thoreau's perspective shifted, and he began to see his nation, his hometown, and its people in a different light. When his friend Emerson passed by and saw Thoreau through the prison bars, he asked him, "Henry David, why are you here?" To which Thoreau replied, "The appropriate question is, why are you not?" He wrote that under a government which imprisons any unjustly, the true place for a just man is also in prison, also a prison. These are the modest origins of Thoreau's landmark essay, Civil Disobedience, his great call to conscientious resistance. How many of you remember reading Civil Disobedience at some point exactly? I can remember it in high school and then early college. Civil Disobedience is Thoreau's most widely read and taught work, and arguably his most influential, even surpassing Walden. When Mahatma Gandhi was imprisoned in South Africa for refusing to register with the police and be fingerprinted because he was Indian, he read Civil Disobedience. Not on his iPad. How did he get that? Was he just carrying it with him? He read it in his prison cell, and from it developed his doctrine of Satyagraha, or soul force. Soul force is the force that resists unjust state force. It's that force for justice. When Martin Luther King Jr. launched the Montgomery bus boycott, he returned to Thoreau's essay, which had first inspired him in college, and used it to shape the nonviolent philosophy of the civil rights movement. Both of these leaders credit Thoreau's Civil Disobedience as inspiration for their struggles. Since January, Rob says, as our federal government has attempted to ban travelers from Muslim nations and increase the deportation of immigrants and threaten sanctuary cities like they established in Washington, D.C., as it has withdrawn our nation from the Paris Climate Treaty and imperiled our planet, and as it has put new limits on women's access to reproductive health and threatened the health care of more than 20 million of us, with all that's going on, And all these things that feel, whatever your politics, feel wrong to many of us. He says, I've been thinking, if it was good enough for Gandhi and King, maybe in the age of Trump, we should be taking another look at Thoreau's civil disobedience. Maybe now is the time for us to return to this source of inspiration for conscientious resistance. That is resistance inspired by our conscience. In Civil Disobedience, Thoreau works out the moral, ethical, and political implications of a central tenet of our Unitarian faith. When we bless a child in a child dedication on a Sunday morning, we affirm that each of us enters the world bearing a divine spark. A piece of the holy actually dwells within each of us. Many of us believe that this divine presence speaks to us through our conscience. Faith-filled lives, when I talk about that, I talk about it using the phrase to mean not assent to propositions, but of lives filled with meaning, with an understanding of why we are here and the integrity of what we do. I also say that every one of us in this room is living a faith-filled life. We know, we have a sense of what fits our orientation and works as life lived well and fully. What Thoreau argues in Civil Disobedience is that the voice of conscience deserves our highest allegiance, our utmost loyalty, and furthermore, that when the laws of government are contrary to the law of our conscience, then we have a duty, we have a sacred duty to resist them. Must the citizen ever for a moment resign his conscience to legislation? Why has every person a conscience then? I think we should be persons first and subjects afterward. Remember, it was only 70 years from the revolution at that point and being subjects of the king. It is not desirable to cultivate a respect for the law so much as for the right. Or as Gandhi said, inspired by Thoreau, obey no tyrant save the still small voice within. Suddenly, this divine spark we talk about isn't just some safe, harmless thing we attribute to children at their children's blessing. Suddenly, it has ethical and political consequences. And most importantly for Thoreau, it has great power. This spark can light a chalice and become a beacon. Thoreau believed that conscientious resistance was not only the right thing to do, it was the powerful thing to do. Action from principle, he wrote, the perception and the performance of right changes things. It is essentially revolutionary. I think this is why Thoreau was so inspiring to Gandhi and King at early points in their struggles against injustice. He bolstered their faith in the power of their own conscientious resistance. Now, even though he teased himself about this one night in jail, Thoreau was not a political dilettante. Civil Disobedience is grounded in his prophetic commitments as a radical abolitionist, an Underground Railroad host, and a war tax resister. In 1850, the Fugitive Slave Act compelled Northerners to aid federal marshals who were trying to capture and return those fleeing slavery. If a marshal came knocking at your door, or an ICE agent, but if a marshal came knocking at your door asking for information about a fugitive, you were bound to assist them. But Thoreau wrote, unjust laws exist. Shall we be content to obey them, or shall we transgress them at once? He transgressed them. His family's home was a frequent stop on the Underground Railroad, and Henry regularly escorted persons fleeing slavery from his family home to the northbound train to Canada. He'd buy their ticket, and he'd actually go with them on the train for a ways to make sure the marshals weren't following. One day, a young Virginia abolitionist named Moncure Conway paid Thoreau a visit. And it turns out that a year later, Conway became minister of All Souls Church Unitarian in Washington, D.C. And when he arrived at Thoreau's home, he discovered the family was harboring a fugitive and recorded the incident in his journal. So this is a slave, fugitive slave, in his home. Thoreau took me to a room where his sister Sophia was ministering to the man. I observed the tender devotion of Thoreau to him. He now and then drew near to the man and with a cheerful voice bade him feel at home. The whole day he mounted guard over the fugitive, for it was a slave hunting time. But the guard had no weapon, and probably there was no such thing in the house. The next day the fugitive was got to Canada. Rob says that, you know, when I read these stories like these about the Underground Railroad, I can't help but think of the sanctuary congregation movement that they helped launch in D.C. Like during slavery, today's American economy once again demands the exploited labor of people of color, especially undocumented immigrants. And once again, our democracy won't grant political and civil rights to those whose labor our economy demands. America has put up two signs on the U.S.-Mexico border. One says, help wanted. The other says, no trespassing. Our economy requires the labor of undocumented immigrants, and our laws forbid their presence. This, in a nutshell, is the injustice of our nation's immigration policy. Reverend Hardy's goes on to tell the story of Liliana Mendez Cruz being taken by ICE agents and separated from her children and then deported. It was a woman they were in relationship with. And the week before his talk, he and some members of All Souls were arrested at the White House protesting Liliana's deportation. In May, All Souls adopted a policy barring federal immigration marshals from entering church property without a judicial warrant that must be inspected by a senior member of their staff. This policy is consistent with other agencies across the city trying to protect our immigrant neighbors, and they continue to build a network of congregations to provide those safe spaces for the immigrant community, Underground Railroad, and resistance to unjust deportations. Right now, Asheville Unitarian Universalist Congregation is voting today on whether or not to become a sanctuary congregation. 15 congregations have signed up to support them. We could become part of that network. By the time he wrote Civil Disobedience, Thoreau was fed up with a government that seemed hell-bent not only on slavery's perpetuation, but its actual expansion. He believed that the government had become a terrible machine, a machine built to destroy human freedom rather than protect it. And his advice to any who find themselves in a similar situation was this: let your life be a counter-friction to stop the machine. Thoreau knew something about machines. He didn't just spend all his time walking barefoot around Walden Pond. He and his father owned a successful pencil factory, which took graphite from one of their relatives' mines. Thoreau invented and built many of the machines that they actually used to make pencils. He knew how to build machines, and that many knew how to break them. He knew that even a small object thrown into its gears can grind a machine to a halt. Even small grains of sand can gum up its gears. With this knowledge in mind, he says to us today, let your life be a counter-friction to stop the machine. When our government becomes a machine that separates mothers from their children, let your life be a counterfriction to stop the machine. When our government becomes a machine where federal agents, immigration agents, wait outside the door until a 10-year-old girl is released from the hospital after emergency gallbladder surgery, make of your life a friction to stop the machine. When our government becomes a machine that denies people access to the ballot, let your life be a counter-friction to stop the machine. When our government becomes a machine that incarcerates on a mass scale and too often shoots young black men in the name of law enforcement, let your life be a counter-friction to stop the machine. When it becomes a machine that threatens the right of women to make their own reproductive health care decisions, let your life, your conscience, be a counterfriction to stop the machine. When our government becomes a machine that dismantles protections for our environment and imperils the future of our very planet, let your life be a counterfriction to stop the machine. When our government becomes a machine that takes away the health care of 25 million Americans, you better let your life be a counterfriction to stop the machine. Thoreau knew how to break a machine, and he really believed that one life, your conscience, is powerful enough to break it. And therein lies the enduring power and the inspiration of civil disobedience. Each of us needs to ask ourselves this question: how can we make our lives a counterfriction to stop the machine? Now, I want to say this. Thoreau spends some time in civil disobedience addressing his old friend Sam Staples and all those who work, he wrote, in the service of some unscrupulous man in power. And Hardy says as he reread the essay, he's found himself thinking a lot about the many people he knows and love who work in the federal government right now. And he says, I know many of you are wrestling mightily with the duties of your jobs and the duty of your conscience. In his essay, Thoreau gives some blunt advice: resign. I know there are many who've made that choice and many more who've seriously considered it. For some, resignation may be the only option to heed the call of conscience. But I think there are other options too. I believe that each of us, no matter where we work, no matter what power we do or don't wield, each of us can find a way to let our lives be a counterfriction to stop the machine. What does your conscience? That's the key question. What does your conscience demand of you? I insert that most of us are not government workers. But do we want to think of ourselves as government subjects? Because we too can resign. Yes, you too can re-sign your time, reassign your time. You can reassign your time in the service of the spark of your conscience, living life that is real. Reassign your time to the spark of your conscience that it may light the chalice of your being and perhaps even become a beacon of hope and possibly a beacon to those around you. Let me close with one last story about Thoreau. In 1843, the radical abolitionist movement in America gathered for a convention in Concord. William Lloyd Garrison, Frederick Douglass, all the luminaries of the movement were there, but the town fathers were not pleased, not least the ministers of the Trinitarian and the Unitarian churches. The Unitarian Church is First Parish, the first church on the green. Apparently, a distaste for rabble-rousing abolitionists was the one thing Trinitarians and Unitarians could agree on. But this posed a problem for the abolitionists, who assumed they could use one of the churches for their meeting. That's what New England meeting houses were for. That's why they were called meeting houses. So there they were, hundreds of people gathered in town for the convention, no place to go. So the abolitionists decided to occupy the courthouse. But they still needed to ring the town bell, which was the Unitarian church bell, in order to officially call the town meeting to order. Well, it was the church's sexton, church sexton's job to ring that bell, but he wasn't about to disobey the minister's orders. So Henry David Thoreau stepped out of the crowd, walked over to the church, and pulled the bell's cord, and sent its call pealing through the morning air, calling the town meeting to order. If he were alive today, I believe he'd do the same thing. I think he'd run up that bell tower right now and ring that bell, calling each of us to make our lives a counterfriction to stop the machine. Or, here's another thought, maybe he'd just remain in the crowd, kind of hang back, because one of us had thought of what he'd said, and maybe had stepped out to ring the bell ourselves while he was just standing there thinking about it. May it be so. Amen.